Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Bye.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
That's how
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Have you heard about critical race theory? I'm guessing you probably have. It has already insinuated itself into many institutions and is making rapid progress into others. If it takes hold, it will completely change the very nature of America and the way you live. Critical race theory holds that the most important thing about you is your race. The color of your skin, that's who you are. Not your behavior, not your values, not your environment. Your race. In critical race theory, if you are a member of a minoritized racial group, their term, not mine, you are a victim of a system that is rigged against you, a system that doesn't want you to succeed. On the other hand, if your race is privileged, you're an exploiter, whether you intend to be or not. Critical race theory begins from the assumption that racism occurs in all interactions. To see how this works, consider this thought experiment. Imagine you own a shop and two customers enter at the same time, one white and one black. Who do you help first? If you help the black person first, critical race theory would say you did so because you don't trust black people to be left alone in your store. That's racist. If you help the white person first instead, critical race theory would say you did so because you think blacks are second-class citizens. That's racist too. That's critical race theory. It can find racism in anything, even if it has to read your mind to do it. Critical race theory is a uniquely American invention. Brewed up at Harvard Law School in the 70s, now part of the academic and media mainstream, it is also uniquely un-American because it rejects the core tenets of the American, classically liberal Judeo-Christian value system. It turns the bedrock American idea upside down. Here it is in the words of Richard Delgado and Gene Stefanchik, two leading proponents. Critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, Enlightenment rationalism, and the neutral principles of constitutional law. It does this because critical race theory proponents assume racism is present everywhere and always, and they look for it critically until they find it. And they always find it. It has to be there because that's how the imperial European powers and then America set things up. Here, as in all dangerous academic theories, there is a kernel of truth. Human beings were not preoccupied with race until the 16th century, when Europeans began to explore and then colonize other parts of the world. Drawing distinctions between the races reached its peak in the 19th century with the widespread use of slave labor in North and South America. No one denies this. But since then, the Western world, and most especially America, has spent a lot of time, money, and blood breaking free of its racist past. It's been a rocky road for sure, but great progress has been made. Critical race theory says all this progress is a mirage. Racism never died, never even faded a little bit. It just hid itself better. Critical race theory, therefore, is not a continuation of the civil rights movement. It is, in fact, a repudiation of it. To critical race theorists, Martin Luther King was both wrong and naive. White Americans can never judge blacks by the content of their character. They can only judge them, always unfavorably, consciously or unconsciously, by the color of their skin. Ironically, not since the Aryan obsession in Germany in the 1930s and 1940s, or South African apartheid in the second half of the 20th century, has the social movement been so obsessed with race. Critical race theory is then, in a very real sense, a counter-American revolution. But that's a positive, not a negative, to those who subscribe to the theory. The American experiment was given a 400-year tryout, and it doesn't work. So let's scrap it. That's what they believe. Is that what you believe? I'm going to guess that most of you don't. So how do we stop critical race theory before it infects the brains of too many decent Americans, especially young people, and turns us into something we have never been and shouldn't ever want to be? The answer is simple. Refuse to accept it. Don't be intimidated by the heads I win, tails you lose logic of this self-destructive, America-hating, anti-reality idea. Don't be bullied into thinking that you're racist when you know you're not, or that you're a victim when you know you're not. Defend yourself while you still can. I'm James Lindsay, founder of New Discourses for Prager University. Thank you for watching this video.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Today we're talking about critical race theory. I think critical race theory is one of those things that a lot of people have opinions about, but most people don't have a deep understanding of. And I think the reason for that is because explanations of critical race theory tend to be kind of glossy, where people just list the major beliefs and claims of critical race theorists without going into where they came from. But at the same time, critical race theory is impending in the lives of a lot of people, either in the workplace or maybe in the education system. And I think people deserve sort of a gloves-off, very straightforward explanation of it that doesn't soften anything for politically correct reasons. So I'm going to try to provide that, while at the same time prioritizing trying to be fair and accurate and not exaggerating anything for political reasons. So to do that, I'm going to be using these five books, which are five of their most influential pieces of writing. And this is also going to be one of those sensitive subjects where I don't want to just say things and hope that you believe me. So if I say anything, even remotely controversial, I'll show on screen exactly where I'm getting it from. And that's it. That's the plan. And to that point, let's get right into it and look at the main thing that makes critical race theorists distinct. In their own words, what makes critical race theorists unusual compared to other academics on race and equality is their deep dissatisfaction with traditional civil rights discourse. Civil rights discourse means the values that society took coming out of the 60s and 70s civil rights era. So it could be the values of the civil rights movement itself, but it doesn't have to be. It's the values that society took away from the movement. So critical race theorists are saying that they don't like those values, and they want to take us down a new track in America when it comes to race and racism. So trust me, we'll get into the new track that they want to take us down. But I think it helps first to look at the values that they're trying to replace. And there's really just two main ones. One value is colorblindness, which is the attempt to take race out of your decision-making process. So for example, if you believe in colorblindness and you want to, say, design a colorblind law, it means that the law should be applied equally to everyone regardless of their race. Or maybe if you want to be colorblind in your day-to-day life, it means that you don't give anyone preferential treatment or discriminatory treatment based on race. And critical race theorists basically say that colorblindness might be a nice idea, but they think that in reality, we're too racially biased for it to work. So if we're pretending that we're colorblind, but we're actually racially biased, then colorblindness is sort of like a facade that keeps us from meaningfully dealing with the racism in society. So that's one value that they're against. And the second value that they disagree with that came out of the civil rights era is racial integration. Racial integrationism is basically having a melting pot vision for America, where people with different racial backgrounds come together and share values, political power, and society itself, which also implies that people try to downplay their racial differences in favor of trying to see the common humanity in each other. Critical race theorists believe that that process has uneven power dynamics. So the dominant majority group, they say, effectively destroys the identity and the culture of the minority group, which is a process that they call cultural genocide. Critical race theorists aren't a fan of that, and instead they want to conserve the traditions and values of minorities by resisting racial integration. Critical race theorists believe that between integration and colorblindness, all of this rhetoric about trying to downplay the significance of race in our minds is not working out for minorities. So they call for a sharp correction in the opposite direction by trying to normalize something that they call race consciousness. Being race conscious doesn't mean that you have kind of a casual, dim awareness of race, but it means that you look at race with profound significance, whether it's how you self-identify, or maybe how you look at other people, or maybe how you interpret just the general phenomena of the world. So this is a radical idea that critical race theorists root in black nationalism and in thinkers like Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael, who both argued against integration in favor of forming race-conscious collectives that could powerfully stand in society without integrating. In critical race theorists' own words, with its explicit embrace of race consciousness, critical race theory aims to re-examine the terms by which race and racism have been negotiated in American consciousness, and to recover and revitalize the radical tradition of race consciousness among African Americans and other people of color, a tradition that was discarded when integration, assimilation, and the ideal of colorblindness became the official norms of racial enlightenment. So critical race theorists want to revitalize race consciousness among non-white Americans, and they also want to use race consciousness to understand America and American life in a new way. So to push this a step further, the analytical method that they use to look at America is called deconstruction. What that basically means here is to look at something closely in order to understand kind of hidden ways that things relate to each other. So critical race theorists want to use deconstruction and race consciousness to understand kind of hidden ways that race and racism factor into America and American life. And they want to use that process to question the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment rationalism, and neutral principles of constitutional law. So deconstruction using race consciousness is one part of their academic process that basically gives them the lay of the land. It tells them what the racial dynamics are in America and where racism is happening. So it's also identifying problems for them. But they also want to present a solution. So the next part of their process is to reconstruct a race-conscious reality through theory. So here's them putting it another way. They attempt to construct a social reality and direct operation within it. So it's basically saying, given what we know, here's how we can present a better alternative and how we can better behave going forward. So we're finally circling in to kind of a full explanation of what critical race theory is about. They believe that through that process of deconstruction and reconstruction, through the lens of race consciousness, we can learn how to radically transform America to make it free of racial oppression. And if that's done sinking in, it's part of a broader goal of possibly ending all forms of oppression. So critical race theorists want to use that process to end racism and maybe all oppression everywhere. I think it'll help click all this together if I give an example of this deconstruction and reconstruction process in action. And I think the best example to give is an early place that they applied that process to, and that place was academia itself. So critical race theorists looked at academia, and they looked at the traditional ways that they felt academics are supposed to behave. And they boiled it down to a few values that academics are supposed to have. And those values were to be objective, neutral, and balanced. And they say those values aren't shared American values, or even shared worldwide academic values, but instead values specifically from the white world. So critical race theorists believe that if you, as an academic, try to be objective, neutral, and balanced, regardless of your skin color, your academic voice is white. If your skin color happens to not be white, it just means that you've integrated into the white world, and in this case, effectively lost your racial identity when it comes to your academic voice. So critical race theorists think that this is racist because they think it presumes the superiority, in this case, of white academic values. And they want to put forward their own race-conscious alternative that would be designed to be distinctively not white. And that's a voice that they grounded in the concept of authenticity. Authenticity here means resisting integrating into the pressures of the white world. So if you integrate into the white world, you're inauthentic. But if you remain true to yourself by resisting integration as someone that's not white, then you're authentic. Then they went further to define their authentic non-white academic voice as specifically being subjective and political. So critical race theorists as academics intentionally reject being objective, neutral, and balanced because that would mean that they're inauthentically white. So instead they are expressly subjective and political. So this approach didn't come out of nowhere. It was inspired by an earlier group of thinkers and most specifically from this man, who developed something called critical theory. According to him, critical theorists work in academia with their political goals in mind. So they subjectively slant their academic findings to accommodate their political goals. And this is also, for him, part of a broader goal of ending all forms of oppression. So that was an example of their deconstruction and reconstruction process in action. They deconstructed traditional academia and determined that it was white, and reconstructed their own take on academia using influences like Max Horkheimer in a way that they determined was authentically not white. So they could use that process and apply it elsewhere. So they could say, look at your workplace and deconstruct your workplace with race consciousness to determine the hidden racial dynamics happening and if there's any potential racism happening. And if they do determine that there's racism happening, they can reconstruct their own alternative for your workplace that again takes race consciousness into account and is designed to take racism out of your workplace. Let's talk about how they come to their conclusions. From what I can tell, critical race theorists use two main sources of evidence. One is to draw on their own personal experiences or the experiences of others that support their thesis. So throughout their work, you can find authors drawing on their own experiences, like here where an author talks about an experience in an elevator, and here where an author talks about an experience on a playground as a kid. This is also called storytelling, experiential knowledge, or lived experience, and is peppered throughout their writing as means of supporting their claims. The other main source of evidence is to point to unwanted racial disparities in America, which means unwanted statistical differences between racial groups. So it could be infant mortality rates, life expectancy rates, incarceration rates, income levels, any unwanted group difference. And since critical race theorists are expressly subjective and political, and since their politics are to locate and end racism in America, they don't objectively look at all the possible explanations for why these racial disparities might be happening. And instead, they default to claiming that they're all caused by racism. Here's them saying that in longer form. Racism advantages one group while disadvantaging another group, which they claim is enough to cause all unwanted group outcomes. This book goes further to say that since these unwanted disparities come from racism, anyone who's not actively working to end these disparities is effectively racist. Because there's no such thing as being not racist in his argument. You're either racist or you're anti-racist, and those are the terms that he set up in order to be anti-racist. There's a third source too, and I don't know if I would call it evidence, but it's a factor that critical race theorists bring into their analysis, and that's historical context. But again, this is done in a subjective political way, which means that they usually invoke a history of oppression to say that something is more racist than it might otherwise appear. So it could be a law, or it could be a behavior, an attitude, or in this case, saying because of a history of oppression, we can presume that these unwanted differences come from racism. I should talk about how they're using the term racism here, because it's not how we normally think of it. We normally think of racism as an attitude of inferiority or superiority towards someone based on race. So that is a type of racism that critical race theorists might recognize. But they're much more interested in racism in terms of how it relates to power structures. So they look at the power structures of society and say if those power structures have a racial bias, meaning they're geared to benefit people of one race while being also geared to subordinate people of another race, then those power structures are racist, and anyone who's complicit with those power structures is also racist. So it has to do with your identity and how it relates to power structures. If those power structures benefit you and you're not actively against them, then you're racist. But on the other hand, if those power structures are deemed to be against you, then you're not capable of being racist because you don't have the power of these power structures behind you, and you're implicitly being oppressed pretty much all the time. Using that concept of racism and using the analytical toolkit that I've laid out, critical race theorists examined America and concluded that racism is a pillar that holds up American society to the extent that America is a regime of white supremacy. That includes most American institutions and most aspects of American life, like our laws, our education system, our culture, our economic system, and our politics, which is all generally shortened by critical race theorists down to being called the status quo. So critical race theorists believe that the status quo of America is the status quo of white supremacy. But it's not an explicit white supremacy. They believe it kind of hangs in the minds of white Americans in a subconscious kind of Freudian way, where white Americans are kind of conditioned into a white supremacist mindset without necessarily being consciously aware of it. It's worth mentioning that the word white here isn't necessarily used in the way that we normally think of it, because it doesn't necessarily correlate with your skin color. So they think that since the norms of America are fundamentally white, anyone whose values are reflected in those norms and anyone who benefits from them and become successful within the regime of these norms may effectively also be white. Because again, this is an argument that's grounded in integration. And if anyone integrates into the status quo, they might be called by critical race theorists white, regardless of their skin color. The point is that under these conditions, white Americans can't just share power with a more racially diverse set of people to break out from being labeled a white supremacy, because the concept of white supremacy is built into the norms and the values of society itself. So if more people from different backgrounds integrate into those norms, then it'll still be a white supremacy, just with a more superficially diverse set of skin tones. Critical race theorists think that the only way that we can break out of this cycle is to change the values of society itself. So they think we need to perform sort of an exorcism on the status quo that expels the racism from the status quo. And then they think we need to make a new status quo free of racism, which is effectively making a new society. So then you might say, okay, well, what does this new society look like? And critical race theorists basically say that they're still figuring it out. They do sometimes hint that some huge change needs to happen, but I'm not aware of any kind of comprehensive vision that they've provided of what that change should look like. They respond to the criticism here of their lack of a vision for how to replace our existing status quo and point to a few ideas that they've come up with so far. They mostly come from books that I've used as the source material for this video, and I'll point to a couple examples just to be thorough. These people argue that we should make hate speech illegal against minorities because they say it affects minorities differently than it affects white people. And this argument is about moving away from one person, one vote, and into race-conscious districting, which means that we ensure people get political representation in proportion to their racial representation in the population. There's some other ideas that have been thrown out there too, like this prominent critical race theorist proposed that we make a department of anti-racism that oversees government officials for racist behavior and is also able to screen policy and reject it before it's passed if they believe it has any potential racism in it. And again, this is using their definition of racism, which means anything that perpetuates the status quo of white supremacy. Other authors suggested that critical race theory might be so heavily taught and ingrained in academia and the education system that it becomes so widespread that it isn't questioned anymore and becomes sort of a fact of life, subtle yet everywhere, like air in the atmosphere. There's also this idea that often kind of lurks in their writing, that capitalism is a problem too and needs to somehow end. So that's probably on the agenda as well. But again, I haven't seen any kind of comprehensive vision for what this new society is that they want. So this is me just kind of piecing things together and take it with a grain of salt. And in case you're wondering if they're trying to lead us towards a future where we look at each other and even ourselves as human beings and not through racial differences, I didn't see any indication of it. So it could be, but the only arguments I saw were trying to go in the opposite direction, like here saying that we should return to racial nationalism, at least if we're not white. So it could be that things like race consciousness and racial nationalism are temporary, and they're really trying to work towards a post-racial world. But I haven't seen any critical race theorists say that. Probably the most controversial part of critical race theory is the claim that they're Marxist. And it's true, but they're heavily adapting Marxism. So depending on how you count the adaptations, they're like third or fourth generation Marxism. And it's not my opinion, it's something that they're open about. So this basically opens up a whole new can of worms. And if you're someone that's already kind of overwhelmed and you're not entirely sure what Marxism is, and you're just trying to understand critical race theory in a basic way to make decisions about how it should affect your life, I'd say don't worry too much about it. I think Marxism is kind of a bonus way of understanding critical race theory. And if you have a problem with me saying that, just remember that not everyone has a passion for political philosophy, and I think it's just too much to demand that people understand critical race theory through the lens of Marxism. If you do want to learn more about it, I've already made a video that explains how Marxism relates to modern identity politics movements in a very simple, easy to understand way, so you're welcome to check that out. And for this video, I'll just quickly say that Marxism for critical race theorists means that their worldview splits people into two camps, oppressed and oppressors. And what camp you're in is determined by your identity. So for Karl Marx, it was class identity, and for critical race theorists, it's racial identity. So this is them just pretty much saying that. Class for Marx is race for critical race theorists. So this oppression is built into the nature of society itself, which in the case of critical race theory is systemic racism. So the only way to get rid of systemic racism then is to change society itself, in other words, have a revolution. So you make the revolution happen by spreading awareness of that oppression, in other words, spreading race consciousness. And then once you've made enough people race conscious, they'll be able to rise up and make a new society free of oppression. And the details of what that new society look like are always kind of fuzzy, as told by the people advocating for it. So yeah, based on these five books, that was the most straightforward explanation of critical race theory that I could think of. If you want to do some research yourself, I found by far this was the most helpful that went the deepest into their beliefs. But if you're short on time, I think something like this can still work, but by design it's much more superficial. And yeah, looking forward for the next one, I'm thinking about doing a dedicated critique on critical race theory, but I haven't totally made up my mind yet. But if that's interesting, keep an eye out because that might be coming up. And yeah, that's pretty much it. I hope this helped your understanding of critical race theory. And hope.
Well, howdy there, Internet people. It's Bo again. So today we are going to talk about what the United States fundamentally is or is not. Teaching history, a theory, and we're going to do this because I got a message, got a question to talk about it, request to talk about it. Bo, can you talk about the absurdity of liberals arguing that we should teach American history that says America is fundamentally racist through Joe Biden's CRT? Biden's support of the theory means nothing because he passed the fundamentally racist 1994 crime bill. Can we please move past the idea that everything is racist and just teach real objective American history? Okay, so just quick little fact checks here. CRT is not Biden's thing. It's an academic movement. It doesn't have anything to do with Joe Biden. That's just not a thing. The 1994 crime bill, that's the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act. The center claims it's fundamentally racist. I happen to agree. I happen to agree with that. And then we have the actual question, what they want discussed. Is the United States fundamentally racist? Well, first we have to determine what that means. Fundamentally racist. If you're just talking about people's attitudes, the people of the United States, are they fundamentally racist? Or generally speaking, are most people racist? Yeah. And that goes through the overwhelming majority of American history. Absolutely. So you could mean that. Or you could mean, is there some structural, institutionalized legislation that is racist? Well, let's just run through a timeline, and we'll see if it's there. Okay, pick your founding date. Doesn't matter. 1776, 1789. Does not matter, okay? From day one, there was institutional, legal racism. It was enshrined. It was a part of the American structure in slavery. That lasted until the 1860s, and then it went through a fundamental change, okay? So you have that legal structure in the beginning. When it ended, almost immediately was replaced with a less severe structural institutionalized legal form of racism. And that lasted about 100 years until the late 1960s. That's just black Americans right there. If we want to stop at this point, you don't even have to get into the Exclusion Act or the treatment of Native Americans. The removal of Native Americans is how it is framed in most American history books. The removal of Native Americans. That is like a really super polite way to describe ethnic cleansing, which is what it was. And that started from day one. And it doesn't matter how you want to define it. At the very least, that went on until 1918. Because up until that point, the U.S. military was at arms fighting against Natives. That's a pretty big chunk of American history there. But then we have something else, thanks to this email. according to this email, they claim, and I believe, that the 1994 bill, that act, was fundamentally racist. I agree with that. I think it was. I would note that while some of the effects of that have been lessened, that law is still on the books. A fundamentally racist piece of legislation is still there. So from day one, from the founding until today, you have racist legislation. I would suggest that that would make a country fundamentally racist. If other nations that are held up as super racist nations studied the United States' laws to figure out how to do it, that might be a good sign too. That happened. The U.S. has a long history of racism. That is objective reality. That's history. That's the truth. You can argue that it shouldn't be taught that way all you want, but at that point you're not arguing that you want history taught a certain way. You're arguing that you want mythology taught a certain way. The United States, its history is littered with racism, with structural, institutionalized racism, racism that would suggest the country is fundamentally racist. It's just there. This isn't actually a controversial theory as far as the United States being a fundamentally racist nation. Now, CRT is basically just saying, hey, we need to acknowledge this and acknowledge that there are injustices that are occurring and using a historical lens to do that. That's kind of the purpose of history. You learn history so you don't repeat the mistakes. If the United States was a person who was 100 years old and you discount this email and the 1994 stuff, and you just run from the founding to the end of segregation, that would mean that the person was 80 years old before they stopped being as racist, overtly racist, and just relied on the more subtle forms. If you met somebody who was 100 years old and throughout 80 years of their life they were overtly racist, you would probably suggest they were fundamentally racist. This isn't controversial. You can ban teaching this all you want, but it's reality. Those are the facts. The United States was founded and built on institutionalized racism. There's no real arguing this. It doesn't matter which pieces you want to count or discount. It's there. It's there underlying the United States' history. Does it get lessened over time? Yeah. Is it gone? No. If it was gone, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Until people are comfortable with acknowledging the past, we have to assume that there's still a lot of racism because you're denying something that is objective reality. Anyway, it's just a thought. Y'all have a good day.
Today's podcast, we're for those who want to discuss it, critical race theory. You know, people have their definitions. I like to make a distinction. I think what people are calling critical race theory, if you get to the distinctions, is it your life or your identity based on your skin tone or race, or does it come down to socioeconomics, capitalism? I think that's what it comes down to, but that's my opinion. Anyway, 619-768-2945, that's the call-in live stream number if you got any opinions on this.
Hello. I wanted to be candid, and I wanted to just speak my mind out into a camera. And this time, I would love to share why I hate critical race theory, period. You know how at the end of The Prisoner of Azkaban, Harry completely believes that his father cast the Patronus charm against the Dementors while Sirius had practically died, and only to find out that after him and Hermione had used a time turner, that in fact it was him that saved him from the Dementors. I kind of feel like I'm coming to a point where I expected some sort of hero to fly out of the sky and explain away critical race theory for the whole world. But as it turns out, I do not have a superhero, and I kind of just have to take the hit and say this myself. This is my own personal opinion that formed out of my own personal vacuum. I have not been paid by any establishments to decree that critical race theory is bad. I am just personally fed up with a hypocritical ideology. I just want to put it plain and straight. That's why I feel so prompted to make this video, because a lot of schools of thought have come and gone, but nothing has had the impact and is trying to make the permanence in society as critical race theory. Now, I do want to emphasize the last bit. It is a theory. Not everyone embraces it. Not everyone takes it as fact. But the major megaphones of this movement are forcing people to accept it as fact. Sectors that I really want to speak about right now are the diversity and inclusion industry, where we have all these specialists come into workplaces and into schools and perpetuating this mentality that really is only just a theory about race, but it comes from a postmodernism background, and then forcing it down people's throats as truth really just kind of gets my blood going. So I wanted to just explain why I personally hate it. I want to exercise my freedom of speech while I still have it, and allow myself to just air out all these things that are just clouding my mind, and I literally kind of can't take it anymore. So the first thing is that I hate critical race theory because I hate racism. I'm not shunning critical race theory because I'm like skeptical of the existence of racism or that I do want to support the KKK. Absolutely not. And one thing critical race theory for sure does is that it brings back racism like a little cycle. It says that in order to remove race, we must elevate and emphasize race even more. I laugh at terms like anti-racism because it really all is just about re-magnifying the concept of race. And then we're shunning people who, not even shunning, but ridiculing. I'm sure you'll ridicule me in just a second when I say this word, but we're ridiculing colorblindness. When really this whole race thing started when an individual decided that based on the physical trait of skin color, certain groups of people are better than other groups of people. But now we're taking that and we're saying, let's keep those distinctions sacred and uphold them and emphasize them, and in fact, give these physical traits irreversible, irremovable qualities that you must adhere to like some sort of religion, and you must dance around all these things if you see someone of a certain skin color, and there is nothing that can do away with those differences. Not an erasure of history, not any repentance in the present time. There is absolutely nothing you can do to remove the distinctions between black, white, or any other race group that there is. So that's the first reason that I hate critical race theory, is it really is this mental gymnastics that just gets you thinking about race more than ever. And then the other thing that really gets me going is you can't forgive and you can't forget. I totally lost my train of thought. I just get so riled up when I get into talking about this. But I think my main point is that we have these terms and then we shun colorblindness, which should really be equality, talking about equality regardless of skin color. Some people act in this and then they say the opposite thing, which is that you cannot say that a black person is equal to a white person. You want to bring in all these factors of history and when are we going to break the cycle where we actually uphold the teachings of Martin Luther King Jr., for example, that we're not judging people based on the color of their skin, but the content of their character? Like, when are we going to get to that point? Because if we keep talking about everything that was done to us in the past, oh yeah, that's right, I was going to talk about forgiveness. There is no room for forgiveness. If we cannot forgive and we cannot forget, are we not always going to be literally just bound to the past? And in the past, that was when the most oppression occurred. So you're literally time transporting oppression that didn't even belong to your generation onto you and using that as a sort of a scapegoat, let's be honest, for the reasons everything is wrong in the world. And then you will not forgive. You will not let it go, when in fact, forgiveness and letting go is probably the only thing that will allow you to move forward in this battle of race. All right, now I'm not trying to get too heated, but I do think it is absolutely important that we're not shutting off the discussion of forgiveness as it relates to race. It's one of the reasons I had some live streams last year, and it's probably one of the reasons I am probably going to have some more live streams, because whenever I brought the topic up, it was like, well, Kimmy, you haven't experienced racism, and honestly, how stupid does that sound? It sounds stupid to me, if you ask. Anyway, I digress. Now, I want to talk about postmodernism and the hypocrisy that exists within postmodernism. The fact that we're dealing with a school of thought that says, morality is relative, and then you want to have these definite, immovable rules and sort of form your own religion while saying that religion is the opiate of the masses, I think is absolutely hilarious. And anyone who calls themselves super anti-religious and absolutely adheres to all the principles of critical race theory and postmodernism, again, you're exposing either that there is an inherent invisible moral standard existing in the globe, that's why we kind of can't escape that leveling of the field and the fairness between groups and judgment and you stole my orange, so give it back. Or you're also just exposing the fact that the postmodernism movement can't be the be-all, end-all of judgment and immovable laws, irreversible laws. Does that make sense? If it doesn't make sense, rewind and watch that again. But the last thing, and this is why I hate critical race theory, is that it is founded on a school of thought that believes you can make up your own rules. You can have your own freedom of action. There is no consequence to sin, and there is no consequence to wrong decisions. But also, there are absolutely consequences for thinking like not us, for not thinking like us, for not doing what we tell you to do, for not loving everything that we tell you to love and hating everything we tell you to hate. It is just a really, really interesting little bubble of hypocrisy, but it's no longer cute. This is destroying society. It's getting to the point where you can't really have a conversation. You are dancing around topics. You're tongue-tied in a very literal sense, and I'm not saying that we should now just go be offensive, and I'm not advocating for that. My meatloaf is ready. 1 second. But what I am advocating for is realizing that there is not one homogenous, not even sure if I'm using the right word, but there is not one mode of thought for issues in the world, and especially when it comes to race. Black people are not just like all experiencing the exact same thing at the exact same time. We're individuals as well. We have our own views, thoughts, opinions. We have our own backgrounds, histories, advantages and disadvantages. I'm not from America originally, but I've lived in Los Angeles for 8 years. I've lived in South Africa, Uganda, and Tanzania, and Rwanda. So imagine that, how that impacts my perspective of the world, as opposed to someone who grew up in England and Nigeria. They have a different outlook, and they have had different interactions with different people. So I'll wrap this up real quick because I don't want this to go too long, but allow people to have different schools of thought that differ from the thought of critical race theory. And don't forget, it is still just a theory. It is not absolute truth, and it is not absolute fact. Thank you.
Hey guys, I wanted to make a follow-up video to the first video, This Is Why I Hate Critical Race Theory. And if you haven't watched it, just look up. I'll probably add a card there. But I wanted to expand and add new talking points to my thought process as to why I absolutely feel that we do not need critical race theory at all. The first thing I want to talk about is the roots of this sort of critical theory, or at least the historical perspective and the philosophical anchors from which these arguments arise. So the first thing is that postmodernism, at least we can start with postmodernism, is a foundation for the critical race theory framework. And Kimberly Crenshaw, in her journal essay, Mapping the Margins, published in 1991, Stanford Law, did credit postmodernism as something to be sort of interwoven into the dynamic of critical theory and critical race theory. And of course, we have the Frankfurt School, which influenced critical race theory, which draws some of its precepts from Marxism or neo-Marxism, and Marxism draws a lot of its influence from Hegel and Hegelian philosophy, as well as Darwinism. I know Marx was kind of drawn into the whole evolutionary perspective. So through that whole school of thought up to postmodernism, you have a sort of argument for the existence of humanity that states that there is no absolute truth, and instead we have a sort of moral relativism dynamic, which means that there's no absolute truth. There's kind of like my truth, my lived experience, which is kind of the way it fleshes itself out in critical theory. And there's no inherent moral law that kind of comes from my nihilistic thinking or atheism, that there's no inherent law on earth. So killing and murder for one group might be fine, and for another group, because of their religious emphasis, would say that killing and murder is wrong. So that's what I'm talking about when I get to my last point in the first video about moral relativism, is that it's all about your truth and your experience and what your group deems to be the moral standard. Like it's all kind of human invented. Whereas my perspective, if you're going to tell everyone that critical race theory is a framework that must be adhered to, then you have to come from a framework that says that there is absolute truth, because then that would mean critical race theory is the reality of the world. But if you don't believe in absolute truth, then you are sort of operating in a philosophy that contradicts itself. And what I mean by that is that having critical race theory taught in schools, being emphasized as the way that the world just is, this group struggle dynamic between black and white, or if you're talking about queer theory, it's the group struggle dynamic between queer people and heterosexual people, etc., so on and so forth. So that was a bit of an expansion on my last point about moral relativism and the fact that critical race theory presents itself as a dogma. So that creates a hypocritical conflict, and that's a reason that I do not respect it and don't believe that we should be emphasizing it as the way that the world works. And so the first point I want to make in this new video is that critical race theory engages in a lot of mental gymnastics. For example, you're coming from postmodernism, which a lot of the people who began to critique the nature of things, the nature of the way the world exists, and the struggle of power, and the release of this sort of hegemonic dependence, I suppose, of like reason and logic and moral law, I mean, they ended up believing that they wanted to adjust the age of sexual consent so that they could literally have sex with underage people. It's like when you bend those laws of what's right and what's wrong because you want to construct the way that the world in the way that you want it to be, you kind of end up in this moral muck and mire that is repulsive, and that's something I can't respect. I really can't respect people like Michel Foucault, because he was all about bending that dynamic and even deconstructionism with Derrida and just breaking down language and saying that, oh, language is a construct by the people in power and so we can't even rely on it. Just makes people start operating on an uneven, like, wonky ground. And there comes out of that a lot of mental gymnastics. So people will be like, you know, there's no absolute truth, there's only my truth. And within that, they say that they're groups of oppressed and oppressor. But when one person says within the oppressed group that they do not experience oppression, then there comes a statement of absolute truth, a truth claim that says that, no, that means you're only just blind to your state of oppression. So there's a truth claim on my lived experience, which contradicts the fact that, contradicts the whole notion of lived experience, but also walks back on the notion of absolute truth. So for me, I can't play those mental gymnastics. I would be all about critical race theory. In fact, I was all about critical race theory. You can watch this video right here and all my videos on my YouTube channel and tell me what you think. Do you really think that I just have been blind this whole time? Anyway, that's another point for another day. But I would be all about critical race theory if it wasn't for the mental gymnastics. And there's so many holes in their moral grounding and worldview. Another point I want to make is that there is no definite goal for equilibrium. For example, in the world of critical theory, in the lens of critical theory, you're fighting to dismantle the hegemonic dominant group, and you're calling their possession of power inherently bad. But you want to also assume the position of that power, so you're actually aspiring to something that you deem negative. But because in the moment you're looking at an oppressor group, you're like, oh, they're bad. And because they're inflicting oppression upon me, that just makes me righteous in my indignance, in my ferocity. And so you want to dismantle their power, but in that, take over their power dynamics, take over the philosophy, the school of thought, the power over language. But then you're just assuming the thing that was bad, and in that you're going to create a new oppressed group as you dismantle the hegemonic tier. And I'm not defending racism at all. I'll get to that at the end, but I'm just talking about the philosophical gymnastics that makes it hard to understand why I need to believe critical race theory or why I need to use it. There's no definite evil. There's only, in the words of Voldemort, power in those who have it, or something to that extent. Anyway, so I leave that there. I'm not willing to play the mental gymnastics. If I state my truth and my lived experience, and then you make a truth claim against that because you're saying that this is the way the world is, you're just making it really hard for me to take this whole school of thought seriously. And I welcome any debate. If you have anything to say to that in contradiction, drop it down in the comments below. I'd love to hear it. But that's my one thing. And then from that, my second point, and this is probably going to wrap this video up, is that if you're coming from a school of thought that plays with subjectivism and moral relativism, then how can you be a sort of axis from which to gauge justice or social justice? Because justice is dependent on a law that exists out of yourself that you adhere to. It's not just that you write legal laws, but you write laws that you believe that everybody can adhere to. And so then you have the whole struggle for justice because you believe that there is a just and fair way that everyone needs to be treated and everyone needs to go about in life. But that can't exist within nihilism. When it comes to sort of Marxist thinking, you're really removing, you're even allowing the fact that you can use violence to sort of overcome the oppressor. You're sort of bending morality to your own will. And so when you say that you're using critical race theory to fight for justice, and critical race theory in and of itself doesn't have any sort of axis or standard by which we obey and agree to you know, live civilly in an environment, then it can't really be the voice of justice, because justice is dependent on acknowledging that we all have a certain law written on our hearts. The word, the scriptures in Romans says that we all have the law in our hearts that says, don't murder, don't steal, don't covet, don't lust after someone else's spouse, etc., etc. So I would rather use a biblical framework to understand justice and in turn know that if someone has exceeded their debt, that they need forgiveness. And I think that's why we really need to talk about forgiveness, because it's not necessarily a fluffy term that you use for, you know, someone who stole your apple. It's like, really, I do believe that there is an invisible law within existence that you have bypassed and it has done me wrong. But I understand in our equality that you can't bear that burden and nor can I. So I will relieve you of that debt. Again, that might just have to be a video for another day. But ultimately, all in all, I just can't allow critical race theory to be the end-all, be-all hammer and gavel for justice. I mean, they don't really, people who look within a critical theory framework only just say there's sort of, you know, a struggle between powers, but when are we going to reach equilibrium? When is justice actually achieved? When are we going to stop creating classifications and divisions within groups of people? If it's not my meatloaf being ready, then it's the car alarm going off. But anyway, yeah, postmodernism or any sort of Hegelian, alchemical, philosophical school of thought that wants to remove itself from objectivism, reason, can't really be a proponent for justice because it just doesn't have a definite foundation. Now, I want to talk about the fact that, yes, there is racism. That was the final point that I wanted to leave off, is that we didn't need critical race theory to have the civil rights movement exist. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. didn't need Michel Foucault or Herbert Marcuse or Kimberly Crenshaw. Frederick Douglass didn't need Karl Marx in order to understand that slavery was wrong and that he wanted to be free and liberated. We don't need critical race theory for the elephants in the room. What we need is actual discourse and dialogue that respects people's backgrounds, respects people's philosophies, respects people's path and journey religiously, and we're able to agree that any sort of denigration of a human is absolutely wrong, and we do not want to endorse that. However, critical race theory makes room for us to associate whiteness or any other physical immutable trait with being bad and evil, still within its framework, contradicting itself constantly, and then we end up with this sort of genocidal end, unfortunately. But without critical race theory, we're not so much appealing to pathos. We're allowing there to be an appeal to pathos, appeal to logos, appeal to ethos, and we're allowing there to be a mixture of conversation and dialogue. We're not sort of possessing or owning the discussion on something and then having precepts and tenets about how to go about with that discussion. We're allowing there to be freedom of thought and freedom of expression, but within that mutual respect for all groups and people, white, black, Hispanic, Asian, whatever it might be. I just think that we all know racism is wrong. I believe most people, just like Barclay said, I believe most people are good people, and we all ultimately want to get rid of racism. I don't think that we're ever going to get rid of any form of oppression ever, as long as we're humans and exist, and we all ultimately form ourselves back into a hierarchy. Like, even with communism, as we try to level the playing field for everyone, we always end up with absolutely egregious totalitarian rule. But we all know racism exists. We don't need critical race theory to understand that. We don't need critical race theory to understand that there's a problem with representation in the media. If anything, critical race theory excuses Hollywood for the way that it represents black people, as long as it just brings in more representation, but it doesn't critique the nature of the representation, because it, again, doesn't really have a moral groundwork or framework. But anyway, these are just my thoughts. I'm about to cook dinner. Friends, this is why I hate Critical Race Theory Part 2. Let me know your comments, thoughts, responses, critiques, whatever. But like this video if you do like this video, and I'll see you on the next one. Bye-bye.
All right, we've been listening to some audio on Critical Race Theory. I'm going to play Prager. I think they gave an interesting definition of how some people might define critical race theory, which I'm going to play here in a moment. But you know what? I think this really comes down to the seventh, tenth commandment. And they're using race. And the 10th commandment is, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's good. We have people that look at somebody's paycheck, and we want their paycheck. We look at somebody's house, and if we can't have that house, their house, then we want a bigger house. The term inequality. If I don't have what you got, we're equal. I think, like I said, it comes on with the seventh commandment. All right, thou shalt not steal. And if I don't have it, I'm going to call the police to get equality. Or I'm going to go to the court system to get equality. Well, I think it comes down to those two commandments stand out mostly. This is just L.A.'s interpretation. And critical race theory, which for some people, it's like permanent victimhood. No matter what laws are passed, no matter what laws are passed, I'm going to find a way to be your victim. Anyway, but those are some of my crazy thoughts. I'm going to play this Prager thing because I think Prager might not define it for everybody because it's just like, what's your definition of race? I mean, what do you call it, reparations? There are different ways to interpret reparations. You know, reparations, pot of gold might be reparations for one person, whereas another person might want 40 acres, whereas another person might want a government check. Where another person might want reparations in the form of, financial aid to college. So I'm going to play this real quick audio of, Prager on critical race theory and then get to you guys, 619-768-2945. But because 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's shit. That's L.A.'s slang version of it. Is we're too bad. For instance, here in the United States, you know, some, not all, because not all people are alike. Okay, not all people are alike. You know, they look at, white people, where they started with Exxon and Mobil and IBM and Xerox, they got a head start on us. Well, that might be true. Many instances. However, look at Jay-Z, billionaire. Kanye West, worth $6 billion. Master P, knocking at the door, becoming a billionaire. Dr. Dre, billionaire, first generation. Okay. Ice Cube. Owns his own basketball league, 3-on-3 basketball, owns his own professional basketball league. These people, they didn't look at what white folks had. This is with everybody that I just named basically are in the hip-hop industry. Hip-hop is basically a virtually zero government-regulated industry. Instead of trying to do what Sony does, okay, or RCA does, or Motorola does. They looked at what was home to them, the hip-hop community. No, zero regulation. Nobody's trying to compete against them. There's room enough for everybody to make some, you know, get a piece of the pie. These guys that I, Beyonce, first generation billionaires because they did not look at the, what's that? The 10th commandment. They did not covet the white man's shit. Bob Johnson and his ex-wife, they're billionaires now because they saw, you know what? There's cable television out here, but Comcast isn't doing this, so we're not going to do anything to try to compete with their programming, okay, and these other cable companies. You know what? There isn't a dedicated cable outfit out here that gives black programming. The birth of black entertainment television. Two billionaires now. They weren't trying to, they weren't counting the white. 99.9% of the black folk that bring up this, you know, they got a head start on us. Counting somebody else's money when you say that. When you count somebody else's money, you're automatically blinding yourself to the opportunities that you're literally standing in. So I'm going King James on you. You're violating the 10th commandment. Stop coveting your neighbor's shit. Prager them to the phone lines.
Have you heard about critical race theory? I'm guessing you probably have. It has already insinuated itself into many institutions and is making rapid progress into others. If it takes hold, it will completely change the very nature of America and the way you live. Critical race theory holds that the most important thing about you is your race. The color of your skin, that's who you are. Not your behavior, not your values, not your environment. Your race. In critical race theory, if you are a member of a minoritized racial group, their term, not mine, you are a victim of a system that is rigged against you, a system that doesn't want you to succeed. On the other hand, if your race is privileged, you're an exploiter, whether you intend to be or not. Critical race theory begins from the assumption that racism occurs in all interactions. To see how this works, consider this thought experiment. Imagine you own a shop and two customers enter at the same time, one white and one black. Who do you help first? If you help the black person first, critical race theory would say you did so because you don't trust black people to be left alone in your store. That's racist. If you help the white person first instead, critical race theory would say you did so because you think blacks are second-class citizens. That's racist too. That's critical race theory. It can find racism in anything, even if it has to read your mind to do it. Critical race theory is a uniquely American invention. Brewed up at Harvard Law School in the 70s, now part of the academic and media mainstream, it is also uniquely un-American because it rejects the core tenets of the American, classically liberal Judeo-Christian value system. It turns the bedrock American idea upside down. Here it is in the words of Richard Delgado and Gene Stefanchik, two leading proponents. Critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment rationalism, and the neutral principles of constitutional law. It does this because critical race theory proponents assume racism is present everywhere and always, and they look for it critically until they find it. And they always find it. It has to be there because that's how the imperial European powers and then America set things up. Here, as in all dangerous academic theories, there is a kernel of truth. Human beings were not preoccupied with race until the 16th century, when Europeans began to explore and then colonize other parts of the world. Drawing distinctions between the races reached its peak in the 19th century with the widespread use of slave labor in North and South America. No one denies this. But since then, the Western world, and most especially America, has spent a lot of time, money, and blood breaking free of its racist past. It's been a rocky road for sure, but great progress has been made. Critical race theory says all this progress is a mirage. Racism never died, never even faded a little bit. It just hid itself better. Critical race theory, therefore, is not a continuation of the civil rights movement. It is, in fact, a repudiation of it. To critical race theorists, Martin Luther King was both wrong and naive. White Americans can never judge blacks by the content of their character. They can only judge them, always unfavorably, consciously or unconsciously, by the color of their skin. Ironically, not since the Aryan obsession in Germany in the 1930s and 1940s, or South African apartheid in the second half of the 20th century, has the social movement been so obsessed with race. Critical race theory is then, in a very real sense, a counter-American revolution. But that's a positive, not a negative, to those who subscribe to the theory. The American experiment was given a 400-year tryout, and it doesn't work. So let's scrap it. That's what they believe. Is that what you believe? I'm going to guess that most of you don't. So how do we stop critical race theory before it infects the brains of too many decent Americans, especially young people, and turns us into something we have never been and shouldn't ever want to be? The answer is simple. Refuse to accept it. Don't be intimidated by the heads I win, tails you lose logic of this self-destructive, America-hating, anti-reality idea. Don't be bullied into thinking that you're racist when you know you're not, or that you're a victim when you know you're not. Defend yourself while you still can. I'm James Lindsay, founder of New Discourses for PragerU University. Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.
Okay, all right. Now, that's Prager's definition, at least that one commentator's definition on critical race theory. You might listen to 100 people, you might get a slight deviation or the variation of what the idea of critical race theory is and why it should be. So I'm looking at it as some people take the position that, like I said, no matter what, they'll find a way to make something racist. And on top of that, how that might be holding them back. And I'm like I said, I had to go King James on. I'm looking at the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbors, and then you fill in the blank. Okay. But I'm looking at some, because not all everybody of the same skin tone, or like you got a bunch of people who have been, it's on YouTube, that, you know, they go to Africa, and they think their skin tone, just because you meet a group of people or on a continent where there's an abundance of people with your exact same skin tone, everything's going to be cool. Until you find out you don't speak the same language, two, you don't know their language. Number three, they might not know your language. They're coming from a completely different culture. They don't eat the same foods that you eat. And you might not want to eat the foods that they eat. And the list goes on and on and on and on and on. Same skin tone. But what's that expression? All skin folk ain't kin folk. Anyway, and it's critical race theory an American invention? Because you can go to any country, and if you study the history of that country, there's been infighting among people among the same race, among same ethnic groups since man's been on the planet. Even within, I'm just going to pick out a thing, this Aryan race. And it is infighting amongst that group. In any event, let's go to the phone lines here on Critical Race Theory today. 410, your mic is open. Okay, his light's on. So 410, he might have stepped away.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. I can hear you now. Yeah.
Why did you pick me first?
Well, I haven't heard you from you in a while.
Look, have you ever heard of Lawrence Eagleburger? He was the Secretary of State.
I'm going to look him up now, though.
Huh?
Lawrence Eagleburger?
Yeah, he was the Secretary of State for Herbert Walker Bush.
Okay, I'll look him up.
Anyway, I was a kid, and he was on Meet the Press. And he said one thing that has stuck with me for the last, I guess, 60 years. He said, we in America have been good at turning people in on themselves. As to say, hey, what we do is we make sure that they fight each other instead of fighting us. And he says, it has saved a lot of American lives. And I know you're familiar with, what is it, Sun Tzu, the Art of War?
The Art of War, yeah.
Yeah. It says that you win a war, the best way to win a war is by not firing a bullet or not using force.
True.
And when you were talking and reciting those Bible verses, I thought right about those two things. You know, we black folk have a problem with each other when it comes to opinions. Now, you said that, and I'm quite sure you were referencing black folk, that we are coveting our neighbor's wealth. We have got to stop looking at other folks' shit. I think that's what you said.
I did say that.
Yeah, you said that. And you forgot some other Bible verses that is key to your position. You know, Jesus had a problem with filthy lucre, which is ill-gotten gain or gain that has been gotten illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And it also says in the top 10 of the Bible says, thou shalt not steal.
It did say that.
Yeah, I know. I just wanted to bring that to your attention because I'm getting ready to get in here now. Everything that has been gotten in America is stolen goods, been gotten illegally. They came over here and took people's shit. And they took...
I won't dispute that.
Well, I'm just giving it to you. Everything they
right.
got is stolen goods, illegal goods, ill-gotten gains. And you know what? You know what you're supposed to do to a thief when you find out they stole something? You supposed to demand that they give it back. And if you have the power, you're supposed to take it back. And that's something we black folks have been scared of. And when I hear black conservatives say, you know what, the thing is, critical race theory is trying to make white folks feel guilty about their position in the world. And they should feel guilty. But you know what? I'm critical of black folks that don't come in and demand justice and say, look, goddammit, you took something from me. And if necessary, go to war with it. See, that's where we fall short at. Because, look, racism is just as American as apple pie in its nature. See, racism says race first for your survival. And we black folks have been taught against that. See, I'm for racism. I love people that practice racism. Because it means that you're going to do everything to make sure that your species survive, even if it means killing some damn body. Or it makes sure that you put systems in place to make sure that it doesn't happen to you. And I never heard any black conservative or liberal say, hey, look, you know what? Semitism doesn't exist. That, you know, anti-Semitism is a thing in the past. You got these Jews walking around here screaming about anti-Semitism, and they're in Trump's ass. They're trying to destroy him. You got females out here talking about, hey, gender discrimination. You got gays out here talking about white supremacy. But I never hear anybody talk about, hey, look, they're just whining. There's no such thing as gender discrimination. There's no such thing as anti-Semitism. But when it comes to blacks, all of a sudden, we don't have a right to go in and complain. And the thing is, American white society cannot survive without racism. In fact, racism is the thing that keeps them together. Racism is the source of their power. And in all of the ideologies, there's racism that exists. But where we fall short at as black folk, we don't practice racism. And the thing is, it's right in front of our face.
Now, could you give us examples of how we should practice racism?
Well, all you got to do is look at the Nation of Islam. Louis Farrakhan says, hey, I want my own shit. And when I get
they have dairy farms. I know they used to have trucking systems. They have their newspaper. Yeah, they've got all that. Okay. All right,
yeah.
Well.
And look, here's the other thing. When Marcus Garvey came in with the United Negro Improvement Association, what happened? The French, the English, the American white folks did everything, along with sellout Oriole, white black folks did everything to destroy it, because they know the danger of black folks practicing racism is the end of white domination and white racism.
Now,
so,
would you call that practicing racism or practicing capitalism?
Racism. Racism is the foundation to capitalism or socialism or communism. See, you can't confuse the two. Racism means that you do whatever, put any kind of system in place to make sure that your species survive. It has nothing to do with those economic terms. The basic foundation of racism is to make sure that you do whatever's necessary for your species to survive. Now, you can put
Let's take this to the animal planet then. Let's take this to the out nature. So, in other words, I'm really simplifying this. The squirrel takes care of the squirrel before he comes down off the tree and helps the chicken.
That's right. And you never see the two mixed. And look, here's the other thing. Is it racism when the lion goes out there and eat the antelope?
No.
Okay, then. It's survival, right?
It's dinner time.
I mean, come on. Let's be honest about it now. I mean, do you know
nothing,
what?
Nothing personal, but I got to eat. My family's got to eat.
Yeah, we will say, you know what? The lion is taking advantage of the weakest species, he's going out there and killing that helpless antelope because that antelope can't fight back. But, see, racism is survival of the fittest, self-preservation and survival of the fittest. And where we black folk get mixed up at is we have been taught not to practice self-preservation and survival of the fittest. So when we come up there and look, white folks do not want their children to feel guilty about being racist because they know racism is the key to their survival and the reason why they have to stick together. And they don't want black children to know about it because black children probably get pissed off and say, you know what, this will never happen again, like the Jews say, never again. So that's why come they don't want it in the schools. But it's simple. Now, this thing about stop counting other folks' shit and covering other folks' shit, God damn it, they shit was because of my labor. And I can criticize it all I want to. And it's not being coveted. I'm just trying to go ahead and let you know that I don't appreciate you out here bragging about something you stole from me. That ain't coveted. In fact,
there has been a lot of thievery going on. Land theft, body theft, all kinds of stealing. So I can't deny that.
Killing, stealing, and lying. So with that being the case, they don't want that to get out. And that's why come they don't want it in the schools. But as far as I'm concerned, it shouldn't be in the schools. Black folks should be preaching this stuff in their churches and have their own schools and to let their children know, hey, look, this can happen again. And it's happening again right in front of our face.
Well, they use the court system to steal now.
Well, all they do
as
is write a law.
Ways they steal. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, and look, I'll give you this one because, you know, we black folk. You know, I used to drink wine with a buddy of mine, and he had a famous saying, free school, dumb niggas. All you got to do is look at history. The next time you ride down a freeway through a city, 9 times out of 10, you're riding through a black business district or a black Wall Street or a black community. Because whenever they saw us getting a chance to go ahead on and try and stand up on our own, they practiced the scorched earth theory. Or either they had race riots to go in like Tulsa and all the other places. But the thing is, see, you got these black conservatives out here that has been brainwashed with this foolishness. And the first thing they want to do is when a black person complains is to go up there and take a white person's position. And some liberals. So I get off and let my boy come on in here.
Well,
because
now,
look,
let me ask you this now. What about that all they do is complain and don't come up with solutions?
Well, that's bad too. But here's my thing. You can complain all you want to. It doesn't matter whether you complain, and you should do both. You know why? Because when you complain, you're letting people know, hey, wait a minute, I know what the hell you're doing. Or either you should complain to let people know about what has happened and could happen. Yeah, you got to complain. Hey, I tell you what, if somebody's twisting your arm, are you going to sit there and say nothing?
Well, I'm going
to
say
something. In fact, you said that somebody was squatting in your house. Did you complain or did you just stand by and say nothing?
No, I had to defend myself.
Well, but you complained too, didn't you? You complained to the court system that somebody was taking advantage of you. You know, I mean,
you're right.
God damn it, if you twisted my arm or you messing over me, yeah, I'm gonna complain. But in the court, like to your defense, when I'm complaining, I'm going ahead on it and stopping it. So you do both.
Well, yeah, you got to play off. You got to have an offense, and you got to have a defense.
As Malcolm X said, use by any means necessary. You know what?
You have to anticipate things too.
Well, you can't anticipate.
You know, something might not happen to you, but you know it's. I think that's human nature because people look at. Instead of, I use the Pilgrim example. You know what, Native Americans were already here, okay. So they had cleared the land and all this, that, and other. And we're talking about the entire Western Hemisphere. And it's just the nature of man, even back then and even now, a lot of people say, you know what, well, their land is cleared off. You know, they got an infrastructure going. And that took hard work. And some people of the mind said, you know what, let's just go in and take theirs because they already did the grunt work. A lot of people like that.
Yeah, I'm too lazy. It's easier for me. Mm-hmm. And since you brought that up, why do you think all European countries have a strong military? Think about this now. Why do you think they spend so much money on the military? Because whenever they see something they want, they go over and take people's shit. Okay. It's not for defense. Ain't nobody threatening European countries. When they see something of value, they go. First thing they do is get in their airplanes with their army, get in their ships, fly their planes over there and bum the hell out of you, and they take your shit. That's why they got a strong military.
You can't get an argument out of me. Matter of fact, at one time, I think the throne of England, had the strongest navy in the world. I don't know how it is now, but at one time they did. And the British Empire, somebody correct me if I'm incorrect, the British Empire, via their navy, they did go along and take a lot of people's shit. They did do that.
They said the sun never set on the British Empire from end to end. But, you know, I want to hear what my boy got to say since, you know. Oh, look, Brother L.A., before I go, I want to find out how I can send you $100 because every time I call in, I'm a piece of riffraff. I want to make sure I pay for my time, you know. So,
You know what? I'll send you a text after the podcast, okay?
Since my boy said that you should charge riffraff $75 for calling
I'll contact you after the podcast on that. Appreciate it. Let's see. Let's go to. Oh wait, where is he at? Okay, 3-4. Hold it. I gotta press the right button. 3-14. Your mic is open. What are your thoughts on critical race theory? Any thoughts at all?
You spent 21 minutes listening to that lecture. Same old one you've been hearing out of Riff Raff forever. Same old lecture.
Well, I missed 3 weeks, so, you know. And I miss everybody.
And, you know, here's the thing. They say that such and such group came and took something. What is it that they took? And people need to be specific because a lot of events was going on. What was taken? Nobody can tell that. If somebody mentions, it's based on what they've heard, not what they research.
Now, Pianca, hold it now. Wouldn't you say if we had a Native
Just one
American
detail.
On here, if I had a Native, you know what, I'm going to bring a Native American on here. I'm saying that a lot of them would say that, oh, you know what? Viata knows some Native Americans because she went into a reservation about 5 years ago.
Yeah, but it should be easy. Everybody talked that, though, L.A. It should be very easy. Your Native American comes on. I was on a station with one, and they mentioned my name, and he ducked out. Because if you don't know the details, anything will fly over. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
What was taken?
Well,
they
would say, some of them would say, land.
All right, so how was the land taken? The land was purchased?
You know what?
Like you got blacks talking about.
They have a reservation system.
You got blacks talking about.
I'm gonna bring some Native Americans on to answer that question because I can't.
Well, let your old boy talk about it. He the one always mention it.
The Beasley is referring.
And when people say those things, you almost got to it. Ask them to be specific instead of be general. Like they talk about Black Wall Street. What black people are they talking about? Other words, the definition for black nowadays is anything that's not lily white. But that don't mean that it's associated, kin to, blacks descended of slaves. So what black are they talking about? Because in Indian societies, you had red, black, and later on white members of those societies, of those quote-unquote tribes.
And I witnessed that myself the number of times I've been out to Oklahoma.
So what blacks are they talking about? Oklahoma became a state in what year?
Oh, man, I don't know. That.
See, they can't tell you that. Indian Territory, so now they say, wait a minute, if they say that they took land from Indians, that means that it was theirs before it became Oklahoma, the state. Was it not a certain Indian group territory?
November 16th, 1907. That's when Oklahoma became Oklahoma as we know it today.
All right. So all before that, going all the way back in the 1800s, 1700s, because guess what? Some of these Indian tribes had black slaves from Africa back in the 1700s. So what are they talking about? These people are nothing more than ignoramuses who are tired of being alone. And you know, most people that don't know jack about what the discussion is, well, if you look at, I mean, just common sense, look at the educational attainment of this group today. They dead last, hyper dead last. So how can you speak on something intelligently and they can't even read?
Right.
When you look at the reading scores in your high schools, because when you get around these groups, you ask, hey, what happened? What high school did you go to? Well, even today, not comparatively when they went to it, the high schools are terrible. 5% proficiency in math, 7% proficiency in reading. So they didn't read this with intelligence. It was told to them at some setting, some lecture. I mean, am I on to something? I mean, does it make sense?
Well, I've witnessed myself. When you go to Oklahoma, there are, as far as skin tone goes, there are black Native Americans, there are white Native Americans in skin tone. Everything in between, red ones as well. But they identify by tribe. They don't identify the ones out there.
They don't call themselves Americans, other words, right?
No.
And they don't call themselves
not the ones I've met.
Black Americans, right?
Only a handful, but the ones I've met, they identify by tribe.
Well, they don't call themselves Black Americans, right?
Not the ones I've met. You're right. I can't speak for all of them, but
matter of fact, they were asked. You know, you had the what was called the Black Slaves of Indians became in 1870.
Because one of those tribes was the Muscogee.
They became,
tribe,
what did they become? Yeah, but what did they become? They became freemen.
Right.
And they had a Freeman Bureau that dissolved in 1906, or 1930s, 1906, 1930. And they was asked, did they want to be Americans? They said, hell no. And it was generational. They wasn't the first one. It was general. So they were not Black Americans. If it was Indian territory, guess what? You don't own the land. They own the land. Now, if blacks are such a depressed condition, how do they build all them buildings? I mean, native blacks, descendants of the slave. How do they build all them buildings? Where'd they get the money to do that?
Yeah,
The creek was wealthy. You had wealthy creeks. You can see pictures of them that this generation of African and black Americans want to claim as being them. They are not you. They are not in your we. They told you that time and time and time again. We are not you.
Now, you're talking about people like Joseph Jake Simmons, the oil baron?
Simmons was a Creek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was, his family owned like over 1,000 acres of land.
What was Sarah Reckner? What was Sarah Reckner?
Creek. Creek.
She wasn't no black American.
Very, very dark, but Cree Indian.
So today's Negroes come along and see these. Yeah, they come along and they want to claim, yeah, this was what they done to black. How you know it wasn't light-skinned Creek that done it to them?
Well, Sarah Rector was very dark in Creek.
What was her income then? Her income then, hang on for a second. Her income then is equivalent to what? $5,700. Per day.
Yeah, she was just 12 years old when she came into all of that.
So this stuff about people, well, they got to be more specific. You know, some of these slicksters, man, they just slick. They slick. They try to throw something out there in generality, and then they move on real quick and real fast to the next point before you can think about what they just said. When you hear something, you got to digest it. And sometimes you regurgitate it because it don't fit right with you. Pull it up. This thing about critical race theory, it still goes down to one
critical thing. If the parents don't want their child taught that, guess what? Then you should stop trying to teach or introduce or indoctrinate a child to something that their parents say, I don't want my child to be taught that. I don't. I just sent you an email. You check that out?
No, not yet. That's on my phone. I'm just on my laptop today.
People always talking about it's white folks that's pushing back against this. Check that email out. Is it white folks? The popular narrative. They always blame it on white folks. White this, white that. Racism. That one lady that you, girl, lady you had in that audio, she was talking a bunch of rumble, mumble, bumble. This nation is
well,
not racist.
The reason why I played audio is because, like I say, and I'm just one person. Some people, well, no matter what happens or what opportunities are presented, there's going to be somebody that will not be happy.
People talking about equity. Well, ain't nobody stopping blacks. Is anybody stopping blacks from becoming?
You can do anything you want to do.
Blacks are disproportionately 19.6% in social workers. Ain't nobody telling them to be. They do it because they want to. Hispanics, 15.3%. Scientists, 0.1%. Engineers, 4.39%. Hispanic engineers, 7%. Ain't nobody telling these people they can't be what be those things. Computer analysis.
We all know people that are accomplished.
Science and engineering related science. You know, nobody's telling them that they have to. They can't. Science and engineering occupations. Black, 4.8%. Hispanic, 6%. Asians is leading all of them. Well, not all of them. Nobody's telling them not to do that.
You know, you got a good crop of Nigerians that are doing well over here.
And white? Are they white?
No, the ones I know are black.
They
Nigerians
pretty damn
place
black
a high family. Value on education, professionalism. Matter of fact, not only Nigerians.
They ain't no Alicia Keys black, are they?
No.
What about Isaac Hayes black?
Darker than him.
That's what I'm talking about. I
yeah,
never
see
them bitches.
Matter of fact, I've never run into a down and out Nigerian yet. All the ones I run into,
wow.
I mean, and then not only them, Somalians, Ethiopians, Ghanaians. I know, like in D.C.
Ghanaians a little bit different. They all don't have that type
motels,
of drive.
Motels.
They all don't have that drive like Nigerians do. Nigerians got some drive.
Yeah, they got some drive behind.
Ghanaians make come in a distant second, but I don't see the same type of drive out of them. And they make up 40-some-odd% of the black males in your elite colleges. Nobody's stopping black Americans from going to these schools. I heard somebody talking about the GI Bill and that blacks couldn't participate in it. Then I heard somebody say that whites took the GI Bill and went to school and got degrees. Then they said, well, blacks, they couldn't go to those schools. Well, I ask you this, L.A., how long has historical black colleges and universities been around? Don't Cheney go
they've
back
been around
to
a good
piece. Don't Cheney go back in the 1800s? Don't Howard go back in the 1800s? L.A., if blacks wasn't going to colleges and universities, how is it that they had over 24 blacks working on the Manhattan Project as scientists, nuclear physicists, as chemists, as electrical engineers? And that was in the 1940s. Do some math real quick. That was in the 1940s. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to have been born at least 20 years before that. So let's take it back to the 1920s.
Right.
Then they would have went to school for about 12 years, so you about 1932 or earlier. So you back in the 1920s and 1930s, where did these guys get this education from? Did you know that there was over two dozen blacks that participated?
I didn't think about it, but you're absolutely right, and we need to do some podcasts on that. Because these people did come from somewhere. Matter of fact, the guy who founded Howard University was a black physician who prior to, not Howard University, he founded Freedman's Hospital.
Absolutely.
Where I was born. And that before he did that, he had also founded a hospital up in, I think, Wisconsin. I think it was the state of Wisconsin. I don't think it was Michigan, but Wisconsin. So you're right. These, we need to put out this history instead of all this victim.
And why they always call it, you know, at the dawn of the Civil War, only 3% of whites had any goddamn thing to do with any black slaves.
There's a lot of poor white folks.
Only 3% of whites had anything to do with slavery. Now, Native, like Indians, been having slaves way before whites did. The Creeks were wealthy. You talking about the Trail of Tears going into the Panhandle of Texas. You know how the Creek got there? They took steamships. They didn't walk. They took their slaves with them. You know, you talk about Indians getting reparations. Well, is that true? Because the U.S. government, in the 1866 treaty, demanded in the treaty, you know what the treaty was about, don't you? Because they lost the war.
Mm-hmm.
They participated with the Confederates. So they had to sign a treaty, and the treaty stipulates that. What did Japan have to sign World War II?
Since you brought up Sarah Rector, that's how Sarah Rector's family got their land.
They got their land through what was called allocations,
yes.
160 acres to members of the tribe.
160 acres each.
For every child, so you had two 2-year-olds and two adults, that there is actually a square mile. 160
mm-hmm.
times 4. Blacks got it.
Every time I go out to Oklahoma, I witness that.
They was Indians, though. They wasn't no black Americans.
Yeah, they were.
Indians, a legal term.
Yeah, Sarah Rector.
So
I don't know who's living in it, but somebody's still living in it. Her
yeah.
birth house.
It was where you got the galloping, what they call donkeys, bowing donkeys, those pumps, it's got her name on them.
Mm-hmm.
Rector number 32, Rector number 37. Matter of fact, that was a commodity in that area with agriculture and oil. Blacks were selling their agriculture to the army to provide food for World War One. They were selling oil to the United States military for oil for World War One. And they got their money. Those Creek. It's their land. You don't own the land. If you want 1,000 acres for your own benefit, you can have access to it for 2 years, maybe three. It's the same principle in Africa. You don't own it. You can use it.
Yeah, that's the right word, access. Absolutely right. Well, look, I'm going to wrap it up for today. Everyone have a good rest of the day.